Hello, Hub listeners. Welcome to the Friday Roundtable. Rudyard Griffiths here, the executive director of the Hub. I'm joined by Sean Spear, the Hub's editor at large. The 15th of March, Sean, we're through the Ides of March. No assassinations yet, political or otherwise. How do we find you today?
Yeah, we're doing great. I this morning, Rudyard, I booked a vacation for May. It'll be our first vacation in a long time, and so it'll be hard to get me down today. I have something to look forward to for the next little while. Now, you yourself are going.
Well, hold on a sec, Sean. I hear that Haiti is just wonderful this time of year. So I wish you and the family the best. The airport sounds a little dicey. I don't know what the shuttle van to the resort's going to be like, but boy, my friend, that's a brave location.
We're interested in political entrepreneurship at the Hub, and who's more entrepreneurial than barbecue?
I really do not want to know how he got that nickname. This is the warlord in Port-au-Prince who's taken. Anyway, we're off track here, but I'm sure you have a great break and well-deserved. I just want to begin the show by thanking a couple new fellows that joined in the last week. So thank you so much, Dee Hardley and T. Scouten. You have signed up for lifetime of subscriber benefits at the Hub. We really appreciate your support. Other people listening, you want to join as a fellow, you can do that right now on our website, www.thehub.ca. Okay, Sean, let's get into the show. I want to start the program by having you unpack for our listeners a piece that we published this week by you and Taylor Jackson that has really, I think, sparked a conversation. I think it's the framing that you guys chose that seems to have elicited a lot of response from our readers, other commentators, piling on with pieces later this week. So why don't you unpack it all for us? What did you publish on Monday? What's the thesis and why the framing?
Yeah, well, listeners who join us regularly on the roundtable will know that the subject of Canada's stagnant and even declining GDP per capita and what that tells us about not just our living standards, but the kind of state of our overall economy and the extent to which it's contributed to a kind of malaise that hangs over us is a subject that we've spent a lot of time thinking and talking about. And we tried to sort of capture these different ideas in a piece on Monday that we framed as Canada's lost decade. That if you look at GDP per capita today, it is now about where it was in 2014. And we don't see a lot of relief in the foreseeable future. And so it prompts the question, Rudyard, how do we avoid a lost decade turning into a second lost decade? And the reason why that's important is that there's actually quite a lot of thinking in development economics that as a country rises up the economic development path, it can afford to sustain one lost decade. But if it sustains itself for two decades, it can put it on a completely different trajectory. Now, Canada isn't a middle-income country. We're part of the G7. And so there are some limits of that type of economic development analysis as it pertains to Canada. But the broader point is relevant here. It seems to us at the Hub that our policymakers ought to be seized, that we ought to be singularly minded, focused on this question of how do we ensure that a lost decade of stagnant and even declining living standards, of slow and sluggish economic growth, of essentially flatlined income and wages apart from government subsidies and government transfers, doesn't persist into two decades. Because I think in that context, Rudyard, sort of all bets are off. You could see the conditions for growing polarization, not just between individuals, but across regions, the potential for the rise of a kind of more extreme politics, a zero-sum mindset essentially kind of taking hold. And so that really is what we sought to capture. And as you say, we were thrilled that not only was there a great reaction to our article, but it seems to have precipitated a bit of debate on social media and even a subsequent article by Tyler Cowen, someone we respect a great deal at the Hub in Bloomberg, in part pushing back against the argument. So all this to say, we think this notion of a lost decade is an idea that seems to resonate with our readers and hopefully resonates with Canadian policymakers.
Yeah, check out Eric Lombardi's piece for us today, that kind of building on Sean and Taylor Jackson's essay on Monday. It's entitled, "Don't Let Economists Convince You Canada's Economy is Doing Just Fine." I want to get to a second to the Tyler Cowen essay in Bloomberg, because some interesting arguments there. And we like pushback. And I think it's, ideas get better when they're tested in the arena of public debate. But before we do that, I think I just want to build on something you said, because I think often we look at this through the lens of, the dismal science economics. And we say to ourselves, wow, per capita GDP, all these kind of numbers, what do they really mean? But you get to an important point, and it's definitely in Eric Lombardi's piece today. The danger, is it not, Sean, is a zero-sum psychology, that when you have growth, you have this wonderful elixir that makes all your problems kind of go away, because there's just a demonstrable path for more tax revenue, not through higher levels of taxation, but through greater levels of economic activity. You get into these wonderful kind of virtuous circles that create for you a culture of abundance. And I guess what struck me in your piece, and maybe what hit a nerve with listeners, and it's definitely in Eric's piece today, is this idea that there could be real cultural implications for this, that as you move out of a psychology of abundance into a psychology of scarcity, the country that we want, the country that we need, becomes something very different. Talk to us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, it's something that I've been thinking about really since 2016, when Donald Trump is first elected. Let me explain, Rudyard. In the immediate aftermath of the Trump election, I think the prevailing narrative, one that I must admit that I found convincing at first, was that people were responding to too much dynamism, too much creative destruction, too much economic instability in a world in which innovation and technology was transforming their economic lives, and that in effect what they were asking for was security over dynamism, stability over growth, and in effect a political policy of sort of slowing things down. I've come in the subsequent years to think that analysis is fundamentally incorrect. In fact, it is the opposite problem, that the reason we've seen the rise of populism, the reason we've seen these expressions of kind of political radicalism, is not because things are moving too fast. It's because things are moving too slow. That, as you say, Rudyard, what people in effect are saying is they feel like they're household circumstances are flatlining or even declining, and perhaps more importantly, that their expectation for their children is now more limited than their own expectations when they were entering the workforce and building families, etc. And I think those narrowed expectations, that sort of sense of pessimism rooted in economic stagnation, is at the heart of a lot of the political challenges we're seeing around the world. And so in that sense, Canada is at risk of sort of being just, 5 or 10 years behind what we're seeing in other parts of the world, including the United Kingdom, of course, where, again, I think to understand the Brexit vote is to understand a kind of period of sustained secular economic stagnation. If you accept that diagnosis, that the costs of economic stagnation aren't merely measured in living standards, but in a kind of political culture rooted in pessimism, then, as I said earlier, it should be at the center of our policy and political discussions. How do we get things growing faster? How do we create the conditions, as you say, Rudyard, for abundance?
Really fascinating little data snippet, as we do each day in the Hub newsletter. In 1990, the median inflation-adjusted income for a single earner aged 25 to 54 in Toronto was $54,000. In 2023, the median adjusted income for a single earner aged 25 to 54 in Toronto is $54,000. I mean, that's an amazing thing to think about. And the yawning gap between income, again, inflation adjusted median income, versus the inflation of everything in a big city like Toronto, from housing to food to transportation. And you think of that delta between a stagnant median adjusted income for the majority of working age population in the city, our largest city, for 24 years, and the explosion in the price of everything else. And that, in a sense, I think, is where our malaise is, where our frustration, and it's, you're right, it's spilling over into culture. I think it can tear at the social fabric. I think it can create real problems around Canada's success story of integration, as cultures we know look to begin to blame the other, to find scapegoats for their frustration with a stagnant economy. Now, let's talk just briefly about Tyler Cowen's piece, because he uses median adjusted income. So this is the kind of counterpoint to per capita GDP, and says, hey, on a median income adjusted basis, Canada doesn't look so bad. There's a highly educated population there. They've got tons of population growth, which, you know, he thinks is great in terms of increasing gross GDP. What do you think of his arguments? I mean, we like Tyler, but was this a bit of a drive-by maybe? You know, I'm sure he's got to churn out a column a day or something for Bloomberg, and maybe the fingers were flying over the keyboard a little too fast.
Well, we are big fans of Tyler Cowen. He's been a past guest of Hub Dialogues, and we're scheduled to speak with him again on April 8th about his new book called The GOAT, about the greatest economist of all time. But yeah, I do think here... partly reflects perhaps writing about Canada from outside the country, that you risk sort of missing the qualitative dynamics that we're talking about. That, you know, when one looks at income, for instance, as Tyler Meredith did for us in an article a handful of weeks ago, yes, we've seen some income growth, but most of that growth has been driven by increases in cash transfers, not by sustainable market-driven factors. As you say, Cowen, who himself is sort of an open borders libertarian and, you know, generally inclined towards Canada's immigration policy, misses some of the inherent tensions that we're now seeing manifest themselves in housing and the education system and so on. And so, you know, well, on one hand, his call for a bit of balance and not to succumb to pessimism is well taken. I think he is sort of missing some of the big points here. But I want to put something to you, Roger, because you said something, you know, I listened to you on this podcast, and you said something about a month ago that has really stayed with me. And it comes back to something I was saying earlier, which is when one looks at these data and when you think about the potential consequences and the need for, I think, us to be really seized by these issues, that this really ought to be at the heart of a debate heading into a federal election campaign. You said you've come around to the view that maybe something radical is necessary. Why don't you just talk about that in a world in which this doesn't just an economic issue, that it's a cultural and social and even political one. You know, how do we go about trying to kind of jolt the economy and get us back on out of ultimately a second lost decade?
Yeah, and I really think this should be the ballot question in the next election. Which party, what set of platforms has the best chance of avoiding a second lost decade? Because I think your analysis is right. One lost decade is an own goal for sure. I think two lost decades could well turn into a national tragedy. So this is, as you've also said, this is what should be seizing us. And it's interesting that our politics is more aware of this, certainly, than 18, 24 months ago when the Hub first really began banging the drum on per capita GDP and the stagnant economy and the malaise that's kind of creeped up around that. But let's also acknowledge that a lot of our politics and certainly public policy making seems to be about all kinds of other things, right? Battery plants, ceasefire, no ceasefire, you know, and I get it. You know, We only have so much bandwidth. There's a lot happening out there, but this is the sine qua non, I think, of the next election. Lots of different ideas here, and I think we will start to explore them in the hub, because we just don't want to be Debbie Downers here. We want to also think about, you know, ideas, policy reforms. Eric Lombardi, again, has one in his piece today. You know, should the federal government be trading tax points with the provinces for, you know, substantial reforms like ending interprovincial trade barriers, like skills accreditation, skills, you know, transportability, credentialization, you know, nationwide, transfer tax points on the basis of hard targets on and changes on zoning and other policies that more effectively utilize land for housing industry. We have to think big here, because again, you can deal with one lost decade. It hurts. It's certainly, I find, it's affected people's outlooks about the country. There's a few times in my life where I feel that people are as pessimistic as they are right now about Canada's future. Two lost decades. Wow. I think you really start, I as a father would hate to contemplate this reality, but I think you'd start thinking about ways to get your kids out, that you'd start thinking in the face of the absence of a policy response at scale to the scale of this challenge, that you individually would have to start taking things to protect you and the people you love. And that then is the zero-sum psychology working its pernicious, corrosive way through the country and ensuring that, you know, we have the real risk of falling into some kind of antediluvian economic and political reality that I just don't even want to contemplate right now.
Yeah. And so against that alternative, the only way to change this is to recognize that we have agency, that even if one accepts, Roger, that there, you know, that there are some low-hanging fruit that really helped to shape 20th century growth, and that some of those fruits are no longer available just to kind of pluck from the tree, it doesn't mean that we don't have the ability to influence our economic and social conditions. And you know, as you say, over the coming weeks and months, the hub intends to start to lay out a policy program with the singular focus of heading off a second lost decade. And if listeners have ideas with that goal in mind, we'd love to hear them. You know, send them to editorial@thehub.ca. We think this is the biggest issue facing the country, and we're looking forward to having a conversation with our community, with our contributors, and hopefully ultimately with our political class, so that we can start moving in a better, more aspirational, ultimately more positive sum direction.
Let's take a quick break. Great words, Sean. We're going to come back on the other side, continue on this theme. We're going to dissect Pierre Polyev's recent comments in Vancouver to the business community there, saying he's going to be kind of relentlessly focused on the Canadian worker, in a sense implying that Canadian corporations, businesses are going to get a ticket, get a number, get in line. This is a political leader that's going to be focusing on working class Canadians, improving their quality of life, their living standards. What does that actually mean? Let's talk about it after the break. Hi, Hub Podcast listeners. Rudyard Griffiths here, the publisher of The Hub, with a special announcement. Over the coming weeks on our publishing platform, including this podcast feed, we are going to be bringing attention to the growing government subsidization of news journalism in Canada. It will be possible this year for many digital news outlets to access government funding for up to 50% of the salaries of their journalists. We think this is a problem. Public trust in the media is already at all-time lows. More government subsidies doesn't make this any better. In fact, government subsidies raise questions, legitimate ones, for listeners and news consumers like you. Can you trust news organizations that are taking large government supports to underwrite the cost of their journalism? Will they hold the powerful, including government, to account? Here at The Hub, we do not take government funding. We made this decision because we think it's important to our independence, to our credibility with you, our listeners and readers. Creating news and original content is expensive, time-consuming, and depends on people like you becoming paid subscribers. You can do that right now on our website, www.thehub.ca. Thank you in advance for your generous support. Now let's get back to our program. Welcome to the Hub Roundtable. Rudyard Griffiths here, the executive director of the Hub. I'm joined by Sean Spear, our editor at large. So, Sean, some remarks by Pierre Poilievre the last week that have kind of rattled the business community a bit. He's kind of giving speeches on the hustings, clearly saying that his focus, his mandate, his agenda for a future Poilievre government is going to be a relentless, laser-like vision for the renewal of the prospects and opportunities for working Canadians. How should we interpret this? What does this actually mean? Is it more than heuristics? Is there something here that you could see as a policy agenda?
Yeah, I think it is a big deal. I'm glad we're taking it up. And in fact, I intend to write about this in tomorrow's weekly wrap, which people will find in our Saturday newsletter. It's a notable speech for a couple reasons. First, it's the first time, as Poilievre himself noted in his remarks, that he's addressed a senior business audience since he became leader 18 months ago. That has obviously been an intentional choice on the part of Poilievre and the Conservatives to essentially askew the business community, particularly the big business community, in favor of smaller businesses or workers. I think in the speech, he says something like, I've spoken to X number of trade union halls and shop floors, et cetera, et cetera. We can talk a bit about that if you want, Rudyard. I think it reflects a bunch of secular trends, including the elimination of corporate donations and the extent to which that's created. It led to a diminished influence and voice on the part of the business community. It also reflects, I think, some trends within the Conservative Party itself in a slightly more populist direction. But you asked a specific question, which is to what extent is this focus on the working class going to manifest itself in possible adjustments to, say, Conservative Party policy orthodoxy? I think it's mostly unclear up until now. Poilievre has spoken to these constituents primarily through rhetoric and not through substance, but we have seen at least one instance in the past few weeks where, when push came to shove, Poilievre chose to deviate from conservative orthodoxy in favor of these particular voters, and that was on this legislation to ban replacement workers in the event of work actions. This really diverges from conventional conservative positioning on these issues. I think, in fact, the legislation was tabled by the Liberals in part to kind of smoke Poilievre out and to effectively accuse him of being kind of superficial when it came to support for the working class, and he didn't take the bait. And so I think if you are in the business community, and you've seen both the speech and that particular instance where the party diverged from its past positioning, I think it does lead to some uncertainty about what other instances will the party move in a kind of more populist or working class direction, and what are the broader policy ramifications. I think that ought to be something that the business community is indeed thinking about.
Yeah, look, I think it's smart of Poilievre. The reason I say that is, look at how the election is shaping up in the United States. It is a battle for working class voters. That's partly because of swing states and the small portion of the electorate that will ultimately decide the contest. But you know, what's interesting is the degree to which, if you step back and think about it, both parties, maybe Trump more through intuition than intention, and Biden through, you know, the power of the presidency, have set about to make their respective cases for their political futures really dependent on wooing that working class voter. For Trump, He is doing this successfully with Black and Latino voters in ways that are completely unexpected. And I then speak to, I think, a lot of frustration in the United States around the effects of inflation. As we were talking the earlier break, earlier section of the show, you know, wages just not keeping up to cost of living increases. That affects the working class the most because they're not, you know, the asset holders. They don't own the S&P in an ETF. Maybe their pensions do, but they don't own it right now. So they're not benefiting from the big run-up in asset prices, you know, goosed by central banks and profligate government spending. On the Biden side, you've written a lot about this. I mean, they have a whole new industrial policy that basically is spending trillions of dollars to try to create manufacturing jobs, high quality manufacturing jobs for a 21st century economy. We'll see if that works out or not, if the heavy hand of government can efficiently allocate society's scarce resources for maximum impact. But that's the political proposition. So I think Pierre's onto something. There's an ability here to paint the liberals as kind of the party of the laptop class, that they are, you know, geared towards work at home, you know, cozying up to public service unions, expanding the size of government, basically doing whatever they can to kind of benefit or at least blunt the effects of inflation and the decline in the economy on white collar workers. And what is the liberal agenda for working Canadians? I don't know, maybe more transfers, child support, other things like that. I'm sure it's appreciated, but it's not exactly an animating, inspiring agenda reaching working Canadians.
Yeah, I'm glad, Roger, that you pulled the conversation up beyond Canada, because I think that is a kind of necessary backdrop for understanding Polyev's speech last week. On Hub Dialogues, we've had various guests, including the late Ed Broadbent, talk about the trend towards what's sometimes described as a political realignment occurring across the Anglo-American world, in which center-right parties are increasingly the home to working and middle-class voters, and center-left and even progressive parties are now more representative of the professional class. In that sense, Polyev's speech is a kind of recognition of that secular trend. Conservative Canadian conservative politics is shifting from a politics focused, say, on a successful entrepreneur to one focused on wage earner. And I think the outstanding question, which is sort of what I was getting at in my first answer, is it'll be interesting to see between now and the next election how much that manifests itself in policy versus sort of rhetorical or cultural nods. Because one of the main reasons I think this shift is occurring is not just because of the economic circumstances that you outlined, but even though I agree with it, it's also that I think a sense amongst a lot of working class people that progressive parties are increasingly focused on identity politics issues that just don't resonate with them. And so there's an extent to which Polyev's appeal is both economic, but also kind of cultural. And so it'll be interesting to see how he sort of situates those two different lines of thinking within an overall sort of center-right agenda. But I do think it will define the next election in a lot of ways and may come to define our politics for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, I mean, I think the tension will be between, you know, a Liberal party propped up by the NDP, which is courting this vote through, you know, new large-scale federal programs, like pharmacare, dental care, daycare, you know, the list goes on and on. And I'm sure all those things are appreciated to some extent in terms of the cost of living crisis. But I also think that there is in Canada, thankfully, a large cohort of people that take pride in their work, that want to work, that enjoy their trades, the professionalism of what they do each and every day as skilled workers in the economy, who build things and make things happen and not typing on keyboards on laptops, you know, from home 3 to 4 days a week. This is a different cohort, a cohort that was the most affected during the pandemic because their work depends on being somewhere physically, on doing something physical. They're not you know, rearranging zeros and ones into pretty patterns and getting awarded for it. So I think I think there's a vulnerability here on the part of the liberals. This group, I think, just intuitively, their guts say, you know, they want an economy where they can find prosperity for themselves and for their families. They do not want to, quote, find some semblance of prosperity through just more government largesse, more yes. government programs, yes. more government handouts. Rightly so, they experience those as kind of the simulacra of welfare, of falling down from the prosperous, professional, skilled working class into, you know, an underclass, the class on social assistance, who, you know, legitimately many of them are there for reasons of health and other issues. I don't deny them the rights to, you know, access, you know, social assistance programs, but there's, in times of economic precarity, there is always, I think, an anxiety in the country about losing one's economic status, of experiencing just a fundamental change in your life where suddenly you've lost something, you've fallen down a rung of the proverbial ladder. I think a lot of Canadians are clinging to those ladders right now and the rung that they're on. And I think a government and a set of policies that could show them a way to maybe even climb up a rung would be very, very inspiring.
Hear, hear. I think we've discussed previously that that's kind of Pierre Poilievre's story, his personal story. And it's one that, you know, resonates with me, resonates, I know, with a lot of Canadians, and hopefully we hear a bit more of that. But as importantly, we start to see a kind of policy agenda that that makes the promise of social mobility seem more real, and as we discussed earlier, represents a credible plan to pull us out of the lost decade we've been in, and create the conditions for growth, for dynamism, and ultimately for higher living standards.
Hey, well done, Sean. You tied the whole show up there on a lovely ribbon and bow, connecting our discussion from the first half to our analysis of Pierre Poilievre's recent remarks, his first remarks in a while to the so-called business community. Well, we're going to put a pin in the show here. We'll just again thank our new Hub Fellows for joining. Also, just telegraph to all of our listeners, you stuck with us to the end, we appreciate that you will start to see some changes at the Hub as we go into April. It's really important that the Hub continues to be funded and supported by its readers. So to encourage that, we are going to start accessing some of our content exclusively to paid subscribers. And that will include Hub Roundtable. So at least the back half of the show to start is going to become a subscriber-only benefit in the month of April. So if you want to get ahead of that and not get annoyed with a message one day when you download the show that you're only getting the first half because you're not a subscriber for only 25 cents a day, it's the best deal in town. Go grab a subscription now, support the Hub, support independent journalism. Journalism not funded by government. Thanks so much for listening. We'll do this all again next week. Thank you for listening to the Hub Roundtable. If you're looking for great daily analysis and insights on the issues driving the public conversation, check out thehub.ca. Our website gives you access to all the Hub's original news reporting and the thinking of our best writers, including Sean Spear and yours truly, Rudyard Griffiths. While you're on thehub.ca, consider clicking the join button. This will take you to the Hub's complimentary membership offer. Put in your email and you'll receive each Saturday a compilation of the Hub's best writing and commentary from the week that was. The Hub Roundtable is produced and edited by Amal Atter Guzman. Thank you for listening.